Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is it possible to have control over the way you die? While many of us hope for a peaceful and painless death, some people with life-threatening illnesses struggle to communicate their wishes to medical professionals and loved ones as they approach the end of their lives. So what can patients do to ensure that the people caring for them understand and respect their decisions? Gene Fitzpatrick is a medical doctor who has spent 30 years working in small emergency rooms around the country. Her experiences have contributed to some of the patient accounts in her new book, A Better Way of Dying, How to Make the Best Choices at the End of Life, written with her sister, attorney Eileen M. Fitzpatrick. Dr. Fitzpatrick, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's good to join you.
You write that dying happens differently today than it did 40 years ago. Can you talk about how and why?
Dying has really become a chronic disease. We don't die often suddenly like we used to. We instead fade slowly. A lot of it involves loss first of control of our bodies, control of our mind. We lose our enjoyment of life. And, I have one good friend who says she doesn't want to die in this country because we don't let people do it. It has become... In some ways a triumph that we have been able to keep, we being physicians and the modern medical establishment, we're able to keep people alive, but we're not always so good at keeping them healthy, with the result that a lot of people are outliving their natural end of life and outliving the usefulness of their bodies and the use of their minds.
You have seen plenty of patients who were ready to die and were able to sort of tell you that, but were kept alive anyway, despite having even paperwork that might have suggested otherwise. How does that happen?
I think it's a natural process of the urge to live. We all want to live. We certainly want to keep our loved ones around as long as we can, and we don't think so much about quality of life. We think more about quantity, and the modern impulse is just to push back death as far as we can and fight it every step of the way, with the result that quality of life is getting sort of shunted aside. I think people, particularly in nursing homes, the people who work with the dying in nursing homes, they become very attached to them, and they don't want to let them die. Even when someone has said very clearly, if I'm in a coma, let me die. Still, the person who takes care of that patient on a daily basis grows to be attached to them and have affection for them. And someday when they're coughing or they have a fever and they appear sick, their impulse is to call 911 and send them to the emergency room. And that's where I meet them. And so often I stand by the bedside of someone who seems to me to be living a life only of suffering and loneliness or dementia, someone who has outlived their natural lifespan and still yet is alive in their body. And I wish that I had met that person a few years ago and said, what do you really want me to do on this day in 2010 when you come to my emergency room and appear to be suffering more than far more than you're enjoying life? Do you really want me to treat your pneumonia? That conversation doesn't happen in this country, and that was the main reason that I wrote this book, is to try to promote the discussion about end-of-life care so that we can make some changes.
I think it's important right now to step back for a moment and talk about your definition of natural death. Can you tell us about that?
Well, we all used to die a natural death. Mm-hmm. We don't so much anymore. A natural death is just letting the body wind down. It tends to involve what we call an exit event. An exit event is some small illness, maybe a urinary tract infection or even a simple cold in the very elderly or a pneumonia, something that if untreated will allow you to die. And instead of going untreated, that minor event is treated for cure in the emergency room and your natural death is prevented. And there are steps you can take to allow that natural death to actually occur.
And this is what you call the compassion protocol. Tell us about this.
We've developed the Compassion Protocol. It's a five-step process that's designed first to tell you what your options are for a natural death, what steps you can take. Our first step is called Know Your Options, so that you're sure that you can take advantage of the simple steps to withdraw from medical care, withdraw from medical intervention, and allow a natural death. And then the second step is actually making the decision, and you not only get to decide what steps you might like to take in certain conditions, but when you would like those options to be enacted. You know, you're healthy, and you're not ready to die, but you can imagine a condition where you might want to allow a natural death. And then the most important part is the communication, and I just can't emphasize that enough, that you have to have the conversation with your loved ones, with your healthcare decision maker, the person that you appoint as your healthcare representative, and that person is going to make your decisions when you're no longer able to. And almost all deaths these days involve a period of loss of control where you're not able to make your own decisions, and someone else is going to make those decisions for you. It's just essentially important that that person makes the decisions you would want, and that that person feels empowered to make those decisions, because they're often withholding care to allow a natural death. And someone who loves you is not going to be able to make that decision unless you have clearly told them that that's what you want.
Withholding care, as you see it, includes things like refusing antibiotics or not going to the hospital for being cured of a simple illness. There are, let's say, loved ones who would have a hard time deciding when that's appropriate and when it might simply be something that could be fixed and bring somebody back to a good quality of life. What do you recommend we try to understand in making those choices?
Well, I think you have to have broad conversation about what parts of life are important to you. For me, it's my mind. If my mind is gone, then I want to take care of the next possible exit event that I have. I consider my ability to think and to reason and to communicate an essential part of my life. And if I get Alzheimer's, I guess that's probably the worst fear of much of the baby boomers. Mm-hmm. I want to be allowed my next exit event. And it's very important that people know what is important to you. If I can't get out of bed, if that's what's important to you. If I can't eat, if food has been so important to you all your life and you lose the enjoyment of food, you know, have specific conversations with your loved one about what matters to you so that they can see when those losses occur. When you're no longer able to get out of bed, they should know what specific things would cause you to be ready for a natural death.
One of the other things that you say that can be done is for a patient to refuse food and water, or if they're being given artificially hydration and nutrition. Is that painful to the patient?
Apparently it's not at all, and this comes mostly from hospice workers who have a lot more experience with this. And they are very convinced that dying of either starvation or dehydration is a very comfortable way to die. People apparently experience a euphoria. We know from famous stories, Little Women, many of the books that were written in previous times about the natural death, where everyone gathers around the bed, and the person who's dying begins to visit with loved ones who have gone before. And they experience out-of-body things. They practice being somewhere else. And apparently it's a very comfortable way to die. People don't suffer at all. With hospice workers, they say that if someone says that they're thirsty, you just wet their mouth, and that relieves their thirst. And their mind begins to wander and shut down gradually, as the body does, apparently with very little suffering.
And we should stress for people, we're not talking about someone who is sort of physically healthy making a choice to die this way. This is someone who already has significant additional health concerns.
Someone who is at the end of their life.
Right, right. How do patients decide that they're ready to die?
That's very individual. And I think it's certainly a difficult thing, and it's a process. It's not you wake up one morning and say, okay, I'm ready. You go through a natural process that begins with your first serious illness, and when you recover from that serious illness, you don't recover fully. And that's the beginning of the process of loss that I mentioned that leads over a 10-year period or something like that to death. And it just at some point your suffering becomes more than your enjoyment of life. We have some questions for people to consider to try to sort of help them make that decision whether they're ready to die. It's very important to be sure that you're not just depressed. You need to think about whether it's possible that you could ever get better again. Is there some medical treatment that you haven't tried that could improve your quality of life? It's important to think about unfinished business. You know, is there some member of your family that you need to resolve things with? And I think an important question for people to think about is just, do you still enjoy waking up in the morning? When you go to bed at night, do you think, boy, it'd sure be nice to just not wake up? And when you wake up, is it, oh, good, here's another day? Or is it, oh, another day of suffering? Those kinds of things. We have a list of questions in our book that can hopefully help people to think about that.
We've talked before in the show about the critical shortage of geriatricians in this country. Are, at least when we're talking about elderly patients who are facing a terminal illness, are they better served when they're dealing with someone who has a great deal of experience with the elderly?
I think that that's definitely the case. Mm-hmm. They not only have experience with the illnesses that are unique to people at the end of life, but they have a lot more comfort and facility at dealing with those difficult questions and difficult subjects.
Now, there are people who say, well, I'm okay on this because I've got a living will, and they sort of have filled this out, and they feel like they don't have to think too much about it again. But it appears that that's not necessarily enough.
Well, I don't think it is, and that's based on my experience with the forms and with the kind of people who come to the emergency room. For one thing, these forms are often ignored, particularly by nursing home personnel. And for the reasons I've mentioned, the nursing home personnel just do not like to let people die. And they are very reluctant to honor simple things like requests for comfort measures only. I think that it's just very difficult to let people die. I'm sorry, ask your question again.
Oh, well, you know, people think I've got a living will, so I don't have to worry, and my wishes will be respected.
Well, that would be nice, but the truth is that they're often not. For one thing, they vary a lot from state to state. Some of them are very well written. California's are particularly good. Oregon probably has the best living wills and the use of the POST form. Most of them are only applicable in a terminal illness. And they won't, for instance, let you withdraw from medical care just because of Alzheimer's dementia. Hardly anyone is designated as terminally ill just because of dementia. And most of the advance directives only occur or only are enforced when someone has been designated as terminally ill. So that's a definite shortcoming of the current forms.
Dr. Jean Fitzpatrick is my guest. We're talking about her new book, co-written with her sister, attorney Eileen M. Fitzpatrick. It's called A Better Way of Dying, How to Make the Best Choices at the End of Life. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes now available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Jean Fitzpatrick. Her book is called A Better Way of Dying, How to Make the Best Choices at the End of Life. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org. What do you find, Dr. Fitzpatrick, are most patients worried about when they sort of try to think ahead to how their own death might play out?
I think a lot of them worry about the burden that they're going to place on their families. Mm-hmm. I find this to be a key one, that they don't want to saddle someone with their care for 5 years, that someone is likely to be a son or a daughter who's in the prime of their life and raising their children, and someone is going to have to become a caretaker and interrupt their lives. And most of them are very determined to avoid this. There's also the financial considerations, wondering about who will pay for their care, whether they'll have enough money for their care, whether they will end up using all of what they had planned to leave to their children and burn that up in a nursing home instead of leaving an inheritance. Those kinds of concerns. And another one that really it seems very sad to me is the loss of independence.
Yeah.
So many people who are determined to die in their own home, and that just doesn't happen because they lose their ability to take care of themselves in their own home. They can get some help, but maybe not enough help. If they're not safe, they can't get out of bed, they're going to fall. It becomes a safety concern. They have to move into some place where they can get more care. And that's really a heartbreaker for an awful lot of people.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Chuck in Dallas. Hi, Chuck.
Hi.
Go right ahead, please.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Good morning, Chuck.
I have a question. I have a living will, and from what you say, that's not enough. So what else do I need to do to protect myself?
Well, the most important thing you do is you have to have a healthcare decision maker, someone who is going to make decisions for you if you're not able to. And you have to talk to that person about what kind of a death you want, what kind of interventions you want, how long you want them to go on, when you might want to be allowed a natural death. There are forms in our book that go way beyond your living will. The living will doesn't really allow you to talk about future conditions. That, you know, you're fine now. You definitely want medical intervention if something happens to you now. You know, you even probably want to be resuscitated if there's a chance that your heart stopped and you could come back to life and have another good 10 or 20 years. I don't know how old you are, but, you know, you can't, with the current forms, you can't plan for future problems. And the forms that we have in our book let you put a timing on those choices, so that you can say, I'm fine now, but if I'm in a coma or if I have a serious progressive illness, then I want to be allowed to take advantage of my next exit event. So you need forms with more muscle, but the most important thing is those communications.
Yeah. Is it medical power of attorney that you're talking about?
Medical power of attorney is similar to appointing a healthcare decision maker.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And are those available not only to sort of legal relatives, but I'm thinking about, you know, same-sex couples and people who want someone other than a blood relative?
Yes. You can appoint anyone to be your healthcare representative, or you can give your medical power of attorney to anyone.
And can that person, you know, sometimes when you have a loved one, at the last minute they'll say, you know what, it just doesn't sound right to me. Does that person still have the ability to sort of change what you wanted and therefore go against your wishes?
They do. Mm-hmm. They absolutely do. That's why it has to be someone that you're comfortable will carry out your wishes. You know, daughters have the most problem letting their parents die. And we recommend often, you know, if you're going to choose a daughter, have that conversation and be sure that they'll go with you. I think that because they're often also mothers and they're used to taking care of infants, it's easy for them to take care of someone who is severely debilitated, even though that person might not want to continue to have medical intervention. So it's really important to find someone who's on the same page, who understands your wishes and is committed to making sure that it's your wishes that count.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jason in Grand Prairie. Hi, Jason.
Oh, hello. I'm enjoying your show.
Thank you.
I'm a nursing home administrator in Grand Prairie, and as I was listening to this and I was hearing the concept of facilities being reluctant to let residents die, I agree with that. However, when our residents have hospice desires and they have terminal illness, the difference in what I'm hearing is we don't treat the terminal illness. We do comfort measures, and we include things like treating UTIs or treating upper respiratory infection to keep the resident comfortable. And for me, from my perspective, and what I tell our families is we want to keep them as comfortable as possible. We'll honor their request to let the terminal illness take its course, but those comorbidities we're going to take care of.
Well, you and I would probably have to agree on whether that's appropriate or not, or I'm sorry, disagree, because to me those are possible exit events. And if someone, especially someone is on hospice, they have said that they, to, at least the way I interpret it, they have said that they are ready to die, that their life has ceased being enjoyable. There is nothing that a few more days or weeks is going to add to the sum of their lives except more suffering and more pain. And they are ready to take advantage of their next exit event. And treating a urinary tract infection does not keep someone comfortable. It keeps them alive. Actually, dying of sepsis or dying of pneumonia is a very comfortable way to die.
I want to talk about pain medications for a moment, because a lot of people worry about being in pain, but then they also, or perhaps the people caring for them, worry about giving them too much medication. Can you talk about your perspective on that?
Well, you're getting into the area of what's called physician-assisted dying, where treating pain to completely achieve relief often involves suppressing respirations and hastening death. Mm-hmm. And in people who are suffering, who have at most another few days or weeks of life, often the only way to treat their pain is to sedate their respirations and hasten their death. And that's an ongoing discussion among physicians. In hospice, the hospice workers often leave that up to the family. They make sure that the family knows there is enough narcotic to achieve comfort for that patient. And the family has been suffering with that terminally ill person for a long time. And they know how bad the suffering is. They know what the person's life used to be like. They can remember that, and maybe they can get a small measure of satisfaction from helping them to be completely comfortable and pain-free, even if that means hastening their death.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Cleburne and speak with Paul. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on a couple things. One, when my father was 92, he'd broken a hip and then had pneumonia and was in the hospital. And at that time, they asked me if I wanted to put him on the vent, and I said no. He's had a wonderful life. Just make him comfortable. And then he died in the middle of the night. And I have no regrets. It was much better than having him stuck with a bunch of tubes in him. And then the other thing was, when my mother was 85, she'd had a series of strokes, and I happen to own property in Mexico where my brother lives. And we took her there. And she stayed there, and I hired a nurse to watch over her. And she had a wonderful 3 or 4 years, had a series of strokes. And the doctor came and said, look, she's going to die in the bed in the next hour, day or two, and just make her comfortable. And that's what we did. There was no, they don't have any such thing as sticking people on vents down there. They let people just, things take their natural course. So, I felt good about both of them. They had both wonderful lives, and I felt like they exited in a nice way that was pain-free, and that's all I could have asked.
That's two wonderful stories. You've had two very good deaths, in my opinion. You're very lucky, and both your parents were very lucky to have you to shepherd them through that, too.
Are we unique in the world? You know, we've talked a lot over the past couple of years about how our healthcare system is different from other parts of the world. Is the way we die uniquely American?
Well, I think we're a little more reluctant than many other places to allow natural death. I don't honestly know why that is. Something about the American conquer all spirit. We're going to conquer death, too. We just don't seem to be comfortable letting it happen.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Harold in Grand Prairie. Hi, Harold.
Hi, I want to thank your guest and her sister for all the work that they're doing. I'm a graduate of the gerontology program at UT Southwestern in Dallas. I've been in healthcare for 36 years. Texas ranks just about 50th in funding for Medicaid nursing homes. What we are doing to our senior citizens in this state, if you did that to an animal, the district attorney would have you up for charges. And yet, as the doctor speaks about urinary tract infections, stage 4 bed sores, all of these types of things, we're completely handling this wrong. And sadly, in Texas, there are some rotten Medicaid nursing homes out there, folks, that it's bad news, and you won't find a pro-life Republican within 1,000 yards of those facilities. So combined with this, with the crisis in the Medicare Trust Fund, Dallas-Fort Worth has about 15 geriatricians, only a few of them are only taking new patients. Yeah, this is just continuing to get out of proportion, the Medicare, Medicaid funding in Texas. We've got a mess, so I would encourage people to buy this book and live by what the doctor and her sister are saying. We're in a big trouble in this state.
Thanks for your call. Gene, do you have any suggestions for families or for individuals who are looking for good hospice care or good nursing home care?
Well, I don't know much about Texas. I'm sorry. In Oregon, I know we have very good hospice. There have recently been some changes in the federal funding laws for hospice, with the result that a lot of new hospice organizations are coming. They are much better funded than some other parts of Medicare. And I think it's important to look at the record of the hospice organization. If you're lucky enough to live in an area where you have a choice, you want ones that have been around a long time, and you really need to talk individually with those people and assess, not only their marketing and their media stuff, but talk with some of the people who have been their clients. And most of them will let you do that with family members of dying people that they have worked with, and really assess the level of their concern and their compassion. Most of them, in my experience, are wonderful organizations. They have done so much to advance the comfort of the dying people in our country. They really started to grow during the AIDS epidemic. And now hospice care, I think, is pretty available in most parts of the country and pretty well funded by Medicare.
Is there a role that is maybe not being fully realized for clergy in this discussion? People sort of needing counsel that it's okay to perhaps pursue a natural death as opposed to every possible means to keep them healthy?
Well, the presence of clergy is very important for most people of faith. And I know that hospice works very carefully with them. Most of the nursing homes make it very available to people. I'm not sure that they're getting involved in the important decision-making as much. They offer a spiritual comfort for afterlife, but I'm not sure they help as much as they could with the important decisions of the still living. I don't know that they actually see that as their role to really help with decision-making.
Let's go next on the phones to Karen in Fort Worth. Hi, Karen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment. Well, first of all, I moved from Connecticut about 4 years ago, and I can say the hospice there is just phenomenal. I've had several experiences with elderly relatives who have passed, and I just cannot say enough
good
with the experience of hospice in those particular situations. But I wanted to ask you a question on your thoughts, not necessarily the very end of life when hospice is involved and it's obvious. I have an aunt who's well into her 90s, and the physical rock of Gibraltar, there is physically nothing wrong with her except that she has very severe dementia. Mm. And I get so much pressure. I spent many, many years discussing what her, choices were for life and end of life, and she very clearly was afraid to die and said, as long as I'm comfortable, it's okay.
Good.
And so, but my point is, I have to fight the nursing home. And I love her nursing home. Love, love, love her nursing home. But every time there's a care conference, every time there's a meeting, they're trying to push to make her a DNR. And I have to say, I work in medicine, and I fight them every time, and I assess her, and she is as comfortable as could be. And there's been a few times she's gone to the, you know, to the hospital for antibiotics for a urinary tract infection.
But well, she made her choices clear. That's the important thing. I think you have to do what the individual wants. And in fact, that's what the Supreme Court says, that we have the right to make our own choices at the end of life. She's made hers perfectly clear. And you're being a very good, loving relative, honoring those choices, even if it might not be what you would want or what the other people in the nursing home would want. You are honoring her choices. That's what you have to do.
For a patient who is still mentally competent, I'm guessing there is always the opportunity, if you have said, don't pursue, you know, heroic measures at the end of my life, if they choose to change their mind and they are mentally competent, they can do so at any time. Am I
Absolutely.
Correct?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's their choice.
And it can be verbal. If somehow they thought they wanted something else, they don't have to fill out a whole set of papers if they're in a hospital.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next on the phones to James in Garland. Hi, James. James, are you with us?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
The phone just kind of blinked out. I'm out here in the garage. But
okay.
I believe everything what you've been saying, I agree 100%. I had to put my mother and dad, I had to pull the plug on both of them. You know, it wasn't a good thought. But I was not about to let them lay in a hospital for 20 years on plugs and tubes and intravenous and whatnot. That was their wishes. They said, if we are gone, we're gone.
Okay. And you followed that. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much for your call, James. We'll resume our conversation in just a moment with Dr. Jean Fitzpatrick. Her book is called A Better Way of Dying, How to Make the Best Choices at the End of Life. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes now available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Jean Fitzpatrick. Her new book is called A Better Way of Dying, How to Make the Best Choices at the End of Life. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's go next to Hillsboro and speak with Patricia. Hey, Patricia.
Hello. Chris, love your show.
Thank you.
I had two things I wanted to mention. One was I heard someone, I think it was on television, say that Americans don't think they're ever going to die. And mm-hmm. I certainly think that statement is true, that Americans don't think they're going to die. That I think they think that there's going to be some breakthrough and, you know, they're going to live forever. And then the other thing is I don't think people take responsibility for their own health unless it's cancer. Now, if they get cancer, they'll do everything. But, like, if they get diabetes or if they get high cholesterol or obese or anything, they won't change their lifestyle. They just want to take a pill.
I agree with you. I think you're right about that. Although, you know, change comes slowly, and I think it is coming. I think a lot of the younger generations are taking a little bit more of a look at that and making some changes slowly.
Does it get easier, do you think, for us to understand that we are, in fact, mortal human beings as we age?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I'm in my early 60s, and I know that at this point I'm very aware that I'm mortal and that I want to make as much as I can out of the years that I have left and that they will end. But Interesting. My stepfather was at a party of 90-year-olds yesterday, and he mentioned my book, and it was met with absolute silence. And I've pondered why that happened, that this subject that generates such lively conversations with 60-year-olds was just dropped like a bomb by 90-year-olds. Maybe it's too up close and personal. They were just definitely not ready to talk about death. Although I find that most people that are at the end of life or approaching the end of life in the emergency room, I find many of them are very anxious to talk about it. They often haven't had the opportunity to. A lot of family members aren't letting them share their thoughts or exploring their thoughts or asking them the kinds of questions that they need and open to, in order to start that conversation. And I find many of them very anxious to be able to talk about it.
What have you found really works in order to be a good liaison for those kinds of conversations?
Frankness, mm-hmm. Just blunt frankness. I think that's often works best for me anyway. You know, I have short times with people, and it's usually with strangers.
Yeah.
And in my role as a physician, I'm allowed to sort of be blunt. And I just often ask them, so tell me, how much longer do you want to live? In someone who is clearly in a very steep downhill course in terms of their wellness, someone who's facing each day a little bit more suffering, just ask them, how much longer do you want to live? And that will often start a conversation where they can evaluate what their goals are for the rest of their lives.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Sarah in Dallas. Hello, Sarah.
Oh, hi. I very much agree with Dr. Fitzgerald. I am a nurse. I work in a rehabilitation/nursing center, and we do every once in a while palliative care for residents, and they're usually with people that have had cancer or severe underlying diseases. Recently, I had this 81-year-old lady who walked and talked and but was choosing not to eat or drink anymore because of her pain issues from back pain. And I just thought this lady was just giving up way too soon. She had a 12-year-old grandson and just was a beautiful lady. And it was very hard as a nurse just to watch this lady. And
she didn't let her die.
Yeah. And I just thought she just gave up way too soon. She had a lot of life left in her.
But maybe not the kind of life she wanted.
I guess that really is a struggle to sort of, it's not possible for us to put ourselves entirely in someone else's position. And so we have to sort of believe that they know what they're talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and again, to talk with them. Ask her why. You know, make sure that she's not just depressed. Make sure that there isn't some medical treatment that could ease her suffering. She certainly has the right to make that decision if she's a, maybe like me, someone to whom quality is as important as quantity. And you know, but don't be afraid to talk with people. They're often very willing and anxious to share their thoughts and to have that conversation, in my experience at least.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking about the book, A Better Way of Dying, How to Make the Best Choices at the End of Life. Let's go next to Glenda in Arlington. Hi, Glenda.
Hello. Yes, my question is regarding a 98-year-old mother who is under hospice care and in a skilled nursing home. And it seems to me that even though she's got, I've got all of this in line, they still want to consider what I think you're terming events is something, well, they should deal with outside of hospice as, and therefore not letting it progress into a death. And so basically my question is, can a nursing home, if they chose, if you push this issue and they chose, could they go to court and get someone else appointed if they thought you were wrong?
Unfortunately, they can. Hopefully, the mom you're talking about has done the proper paperwork that gives you that power. As long as that paperwork is intact, then they're not going to be able to interfere with the power of that healthcare decision maker, not in the modern world.
30 years ago, yes, they could have made sure that that person was kept alive as long as possible. But the Supreme Court has been very clear that the wishes of the person as expressed to their health care representative have to be honored. And you can force that nursing home to abide by the loved one's wishes.
You mentioned earlier that on occasion, you know, folks who work at a nursing home are just sort of attached to the patients and they care about them and they don't want to see them die. Is there also, do you also worry that there is some concern on the administrative level about lawsuits if they don't take these measures, even if a patient has said they don't want them?
I don't think that's a primary motivator. Mm-hmm. I really don't. I wonder sometimes if finances might be a motivator. You know, they have a paying customer in that bed, and they don't want an empty bed. That's a fairly cynical approach, and I hope that doesn't operate often, but I fear that it does. I know that finances play a large role in every decision in life. But I think the primary one is just the attachment and their own fear of death and their own unwillingness to admit that death is a natural part of life.
Let's go back. We have time for another call, this one from Karen in Rockwall. Hey, Karen.
Yes, hi. I'd just like to share that my mom passed away. She passed like 3 months ago, and she lived on a little farm, and she went the hospice route, and she had peacocks that she had raised for about 48 years, and on the day that she passed, I was sitting by her bed, and it was 10 till 3, and I thought, well, it looked like maybe she might be ready to, you know, to the breathing got very labored. And all of a sudden, all the peacocks lined up outside her bedroom window. And at 3 minutes after 3, she passed. Hmm. And then they all just walked off.
Well, that's a wonderful story.
They were so aware that it was time for her to go, and I thought it was so sweet. So
I came to say goodbye.
Just wanted to share that with you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your call.
Sorry for your loss.
You know, it is interesting, Dr. Fitzpatrick. So often people will report that being with a loved one at the moment of their death is oddly a beautiful experience.
Yes. And I don't know what's odd about it. It's a transformation of energy from one plane of existence to some other, whatever happens next, whatever your belief system is. And it can't help but be a powerful event. And when it's filled with love, you know, it should be a transformative experience.
We'll go back to the phones now and speak with April in Plano. Hi, April.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question for your guest. I'm going through an experience right now with my sister's father. He's kind of like a stepfather to me, mm-hmm. but he's very ill. He's only in his about 55. And he's had several heart attacks, and basically his blood pressure drops a lot. And then they give him medicine to make his blood pressure go back up. But it's not looking good for him, basically, is what the doctors have told us. And we're trying to get him to make decisions about what he wants to do, whether he wants us to keep giving him these. Because they told us that if he was on a strict DNR, that they wouldn't be giving him this medicine to get his blood pressure back up.
So he's not ready I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you're asking if he doesn't want to talk about it, how do you broach the subject?
Exactly, yeah. Because right now my oldest sister is his next of kin, and she would have to make decisions for him, but our family won't agree on what the right decision is. Yeah. So we're trying to get him to make the decision himself.
Dr. Fitzpatrick?
Right, and you have to come at it out of love, out of his love for you and yours for him. You say, every day that you're with us is a blessing for both of us, and we hope you can stay with us forever, but reality is that we know change is coming, and there's going to be a time at some point where we're going to have to make decisions for you, and when that happens, we really hope that we can make the decisions that you want, and we can only do that if you'll share with us what you want those decisions to be. If you want us to keep you alive forever, tell us, and that's what we'll do. If there's a point where you want us to stop seeking medical care and let nature take its course, tell us what that point is so that we can make decisions that are the ones you want. You know, make sure that they know that you're asking out of love and affection for them, and because you want to be sure to do what they want.
Do you find a lot of people who feel sort of obligated to keep living based on the wishes of their loved ones?
Not so much. Mm-hmm. People seem to get a strength as they're approaching the end of life, and determination. They will stay alive out of their own desire to stay connected with people, but not just because someone else can't let them go. I really don't see that very much.
I imagine you have seen some families and loved ones come together in really remarkable ways once a loved one has made the decision that they are ready to die and sort of acknowledge their love for that person before they're gone. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, that's the classic good death, and that's the one where the family gathers around the bed and all has a chance to say goodbye and express their love and reaffirm their values, their shared humanity. It's a beautiful thing when it happens. Unfortunately, 80% of people in this country don't die at home in their own bed. They die in nursing homes and in hospitals. And I think the location of the death is very important in that. And I think also the amount of control that the person is able to exercise.
Do you find that doctors can candidly discuss with one another their opinions on how this should go?
Well, I've been in practice of medicine for 25 years, and the change that has happened during those 25 years is very heartwarming to see. I think there's a whole new generation of people who are more comfortable talking about important things, not only about death, but talking about quality of life among healthy people. And I think there has been a good change. You know, all change comes gradually.
Are there any other important issues surrounding terminal illness that we're not talking enough about in this country that we haven't discussed today?
Well, I think the one that we're most reluctant to talk about is the Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And people are living for 10 years, 15 years in Alzheimer's wards and being kept alive. And I think that's the one that needs most discussion because people are offered a natural death from Alzheimer's, and the death is from not eating. When about the time that you forget to get up to go to the bathroom or forget to look both ways before you cross the street, you also forget to eat. And my healthcare decision maker knows that if I lose my mind, I want food and water set by my bedside 3 times a day, and I want to be allowed to take it if I remember. And if I forget, I don't want someone to remind me. If I can't remember to eat as much as I love food, then I'm ready to die. And I would like to be allowed to die the very comfortable death that comes from not eating and drinking.
Jean Fitzpatrick is a medical doctor and author of the new book, A Better Way of Dying, How to Make the Best Choices at the End of Life. Dr. Fitzpatrick, thank you so much for sharing the hour with us.
Thank you very much, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.